Wayne Butler, alcoholic. Thank you. Appreciate your talk. Appreciate being invited to speak. I love AA. If you're new, I'm going to ask you to do yourself a favor. Don't judge AA according to my presentation. You don't like me? Tough. I love the lights in here because it gives me a chance to see you so I can judge you back. I love it when we talk about non-judgmentalness in AA. I think, really? Okay. I'll try. I love this deal. I heard you had Roger last week. I'm sorry. He's one of my favorites. We were talking today about somebody mistook him from being from Alabama, and I said, no, the people in Alabama don't marry their relatives. And, okay. I'm from Illinois. We just don't get married. And I have a history of near misses. I drank a lot. I love to drink. If I could get away with it, I have to tell you newer people something. If I could get away with it, I'd drink today. I'm not mad at it. It didn't do nothing to me. If it did, I'd have quit early on if it would have done something to me that was more dramatic than what it did for me. And I didn't know alcohol was doing something for me until I found you guys. And I was the youngest guy in AA at one time, believe it or not. I was 23 years old. I was in the state of Illinois. That was approximately, 38 years ago. I remember when they said, if you want what we have, I thought, really? Osteoporosis? Hey, Bob, can I have some of that oxygen, please? And I didn't stay sober, of course. I remember I went to AA meetings for 5 years and drank the entire time. I met you guys, and I have to tell you the truth. After talking to you for about 5 minutes, I found it absolutely necessary to drink again. If you're new, obviously it's not a requirement to go out and drink again, but if you do, you're welcome to come back. Nobody's judging you. If they are, they're judging themselves. I want you to hear that. You hear a lot of people talk about how they never had to drink again, and it may feel to you like they're saying they're better than you. They are. No, I'm kidding. We're really equal here. I want to congratulate all the CHIP people. Lena's in my home group, and I love watching her. She came to us 30 days ago, and she was all medicated out and drunk, and today she's here 30 days with no pills, powders, potions, or lotions. Isn't that something? Completely free of all of those things. My sobriety date, by the way, is November 8th, 1977. I haven't any booze, any pills, powders, potions, or lotions that affect my emotions from that day to this. However, it has been rumored I needed them. I have actually had people in AA come up to me and suggest I go see a doctor. I have no opinion. My sponsor suggested I go see a big book. That's not an opinion on anybody else that does what they do. It's just that I'm going to talk about this a little bit. I believe in our traditions. There's a lot of things that are a part of my story, and I'm not going to use that to disrespect our program. I will tell you that I am a member of the Gravely Mentally Emotionally Disabled Unit of AA. I have more emotional disorders than the DSM-3. They've advanced to the DSM-4. Getting ready to print the DSM-5. I've been diagnosed psychiatrically since I was 12. One of the diagnoses I never received was alcoholic. And why? I wasn't drinking yet. I really identify with you. I was a late bloomer. I didn't drink my first drink until I was 17. And I was in an interesting position. I just want to preface this real quick. I have a brief amount of time. And I really want to tell a story about how I got into AA because it's really, I'm enamored by it. When I was in school, I came from an alcoholic home too. And I'm not going to talk too much about that to respect my mom and dad's memory. My mom and dad weren't bad parents. They were sick parents. And they did a lot of things that I believe in my heart they would not have done if they weren't sick. And our big book codified that. It said that perhaps they were spiritually sick. And I never looked at my mom and dad as sick. And neither did society. Society looked at my mom and dad as evil, bad people. To the untrained eye, they probably were. And I did never want to be like my dad. And they didn't make me alcoholic, but they definitely put a definite spin on my personality. And the reason it's relevant is because you had to deal with the outcome of that when I got here. And I'm glad you didn't let me off the hook. I'm glad you didn't allow me to blame my parents. I'm glad that the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous held me accountable through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, the steps throughout our book and throughout our history say, look at yourself, don't look at them. Putting out of the minds the wrongs others done us. I don't do that well. I like to look at you and find your fault. There I can drink. I can keep drinking. And it was always the cop's fault. It was always the, they were always sneaky. They were always running radar in a bad spot. They were always catching me. I always found fault with somebody. And it's funny that I never did blame Budweiser, though. I mean, I'm just a beer drinker. Any other just beer drinkers in the room? And that young lady, I'll bet you she drank more than I did. If quantity of alcohol is a qualifier, I probably don't qualify. I never drank that much. I lived on Skid Row for 5 years. I lived in a dumpster for 5 years behind Larry's Oasis. I wasn't drunk most of the time. But I did drink for the effect. I fit in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous because once I did start, I couldn't stop. And I did such horrible things that I would go as long as I could controlling it, not drinking because of what I was afraid I might do the next time. And I would always end up taking a drink. And I didn't know why because I just drank beer. Come on, beer's harmless for God's sake. Anybody can drink. Girls can drink beer. That's what, no offense, ladies. Budweiser done something for me that was so powerful and dynamic that even though I knew I was probably going to do something really bad, I was more afraid I'd do something worse sober. So I was caught in this conundrum in my life. I couldn't drink, I couldn't not drink, and I was left with nobody to blame because I knew it was on me. And I didn't know how to deal with that. And after going to meetings for 5 years and drinking, and I'll tell you what, AA will screw up your drinking. It quick. But where it started was in that alcoholic home. I want to tell you about that just for a minute so you understand how powerful. If there's anybody new in the room, it's got to be hard to conceptualize how powerful AA really is. Unless you've been around for a while and observed the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. In eighth grade, I was acting kind of funny. Anybody else acting out? They didn't have ADD back then, or I'd have had it. I'd have had ADD, DDDDD. I was a troubled child. They were giving me all kinds of tests, putting me on medication, trying to calm me down. I remember in eighth grade, they gave me an IQ test. How many of you have taken? We got some smart guys in here. I saw you already. Don't try to hide. I got to see the smart guys. You're bleeding intelligence, I can tell. They gave me, in the 1960s, the early 60s, when the IQ test came out, they gave it to me trying to figure out why I was acting peculiar. I took that test. I want you to know something. If you score a 120, you're pretty smart. You're really smart. You score a 150, you're going to get a job and get paid to think. You're Mensa material. If you score over a 180 or above, they just tell you to stay home. You're too smart to drive your car. I want you to know what I scored on that test. I scored a 57. I didn't cheat. And I got diagnosed retarded. Not special ed. Retarded. I know this is AA. Hang with me for a minute. I got put in a retarded class, and by God, I improved. And I rode a short bus for 4 years. It wasn't fun, folks, watching a long bus go by. And all you bullies, I spotted you guys already. See, all the, you know, the bullies, you know, the other tough guys that have to beat up retarded kids. They ought to be proud of themselves. They're in AA, too. I spotted them. You're here. I saw you. Don't look away now. You're already caught. Because they were beating on us so bad, the school assigned us protectors, I guess you'd call it. You know, the brown nosers, you know, the ones that want extra credit in school. You know, much like sponsees to get their sponsors coffee. Thanks, by the way. They assigned a guy. I'm going to tell you two stories. That's how much time I've got. And I want to tell you those two stories because they're poignant about not only the power of alcohol, but the power of AA. I got put in that special class, and the bullies were out, and I was already filled with self-centered fear. I already had these emotions I didn't know what to do with. Society didn't know what to do with them. I felt odd. I felt different. And they couldn't call it alcoholism because I wasn't drinking yet. I think I was a potential Al-Anon until I drank, to be fair. But I remember all through school, Tom was my guy. Tom protected me. Tom was a classmate who, he was in the real class, and he'd come pick me up at the special class and take me home and blah, 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 put me on the bus, blah, blah, blah. One night, these three wrestlers grabbed three of us kids from the special class. Now, I'm the only one that didn't have organicity. The other two had downs. They locked the three of us, each one of us, in a hall locker on Friday night. They didn't find us till Monday. And they thought that was cute. Now, those other two kids came out as organic as they went in, scared, but I came out different. I came out with something I didn't know what I had till I met you guys. I had a resentment. And I wouldn't have retaliated if I knew I was going to have to do an 8-step when I got to AA. I'll tell you that right now. I'd have probably forgave him. Tom beat the hell out of all three of them. And Tom was my hero from then on. Tom was a bottle of booze for me. I didn't know that until our senior year. I'm the only one that got to go to the senior dance. Now, I've been playing putt-putt for 4 years. That's all we did. We didn't read books. I'm not an academic, in case you can't tell. I've never ruined a book, I promise. Never written in one until I got the big book. First one I got to mark in. It's amazing. We played putt-putt. That's what we did. I can still play putt-putt. And Tom took me to the senior dance. I want to tell you how powerful booze is. Tom took me to senior dance. I'm not drinking whiskey because I saw my dad drink whiskey and beat my mom. And then it came downhill. I watched my mom drink tequila. I watched her beat up my dad. I was happy about that. And things happen that shouldn't happen to kids, but it does. It happens to kids that aren't alcoholic. It happens to kids that get recover just fine. But it happened to me. And Tom walked up on me. I'm at the senior dance, and I'm looking at all these kids dancing. I've never danced. I've putt-putt. You know what I mean? Putt-putt, and I can run because I can outrun the bullies. I can run. Forrest Gump is my hero. Run, Forrest. Okay. I could run. So I'm standing there watching these kids dance. I've got a 57 IQ. I'm not doing well. Tom walks up on me, and he opens up his jacket, and he sneaks out this long brown bottle. It's a Budweiser, red, white, and blue label. He says to me, he said, here, kid, drink this. It'll make you feel better. I would have drank battery acid for Tom. Tom protected me from the bullies. Tom protected me from the evil, what's going on. Tom protected me from my own father. I would have drank battery acid for Tom. I drank that bottle of Budweiser straight down. I did. I didn't even breathe. And then I let out a big old belch, and I said to Tom, Tom, that tastes terrible. I want a Pepsi Cola. Tom looks at me. He says, that's okay, kid. You'll get used to it. Now, here's what Tom meant. You see, Tom is a normal drinker even to this day. I've known Tom my whole life. We have stayed in touch this whole 32 years I've been sober. He's only gone to one meeting to watch me celebrate. He says, I'm glad you're there. I'll never go back. And he says, that's one of the best de-retarding programs I've ever seen. He doesn't need to know. Here's what Tom meant when he said, I'll get over it. You see, what happened to Tom the first time he drank as a dumb kid, he didn't understand the natural effects of alcohol. He drank too much too quick, got dizzy, got disorientated, thought he was in the bathroom. He was actually in the bedroom, peed in his dresser. And he almost went crazy trying to flush it. And his mother said, you better not ever do that again. And from that day to this day, Tom has not. Tom is a big member of society in the town I come from. He's into politics. He's doing great. He just never had a problem. He never even tried to control his drinking. It's not an issue. And then there's me. All I can tell you is that's what he meant when he said I'd get used to it. But somewhere between 4 and 5 Budweisers, I got so good looking I couldn't stand it. And my IQ jumped. I got really clever, too. And I've never danced in my life, except when I'm running from the bullies, you know what I mean? I looked out on that dance floor and eyeballed me a blue-eyed blonde dancing with some loser. I walked right up to her and stole some words I'd overheard. Can I cut in? I had no idea what to do. So the first dance I had, she led. Does that tell you anything? And then we danced again. She realized I was in the special class. We danced again. She gave me a couple sympathy dances. And then she started to like me because I'm a bit of a character. She started liking me even more. We found out later that night sex meant two people. What a surprise. I didn't know that. They weren't teaching us sex ed in the other class. They didn't even want to give us a clue. They didn't want to hint what that was about, a fear we might reproduce. She ruined my sex life immediately. I considered myself quite an expert because I've been having sex since I was 13. And she complicated the entire procedure. I had what I now know as a blackout. I couldn't remember. Tom told me I had a great time. I could remember the complicated part, but a lot of it slipped by me. I couldn't remember what happened after that. We went back to school. We had about 6 weeks or 7 weeks of school left, and after about 4 weeks, I got called into the principal's office, and I didn't. They didn't call the retarded kids and the special kids into the principal's office. That just didn't happen. I got called in. Make a long story short, I get to the principal's office, and there's my mom and dad. Dad didn't go to school. He drank and drove truck and beat people up. That's what my dad did. My mom, she didn't go to school. She was a German, a stout German woman, stood about this big, tatted out from the neck down. My mom had flying eagles tattooed on each forearm, had a double-breasted golden eagle across her back. They called her a painted lady. Once. I used to love to watch my mom. She used to beat men up. It was great. She just pound them. You know what I mean? So there's my mom and dad. Now, I haven't seen the girl from the dance for 4 weeks. I don't know what happened to her. And I look to my left, and there she is in the principal's office. I got happy. And then sitting next to her is her mom and dad. They weren't happy. And as I walk in, her dad starts to get out of his chair, and he's got to be restrained. He's screaming at me. You got my daughter pregnant. You the one that had sex with my daughter? I said. Then I said, can I do it again? They were going to have me arrested for statutory rape. She was 16, I was 17. In the state of Illinois, any boy 14 or older has sex with a girl 16 or younger, statutory rape. It's mandatory 20 years to life. And her dad informed me I was going to get the mandatory sentence. And as soon as he says, you're going to go to prison for rape, and I said, even if I'm retarded? We got married. I don't have time to tell you that story. I wish I did. We'd have went to Kentucky if we'd have known, but we went to Missouri instead. Okay, I don't have time to tell you the rest. But that experience, it wasn't the trouble that made me alcoholic. Lots of people have trouble drinking alcohol that are not alcoholic. But it's that spiritual thing that took place inside of me, that welling up of okayness while I'm drinking. It ain't supposed to do that. I didn't know that till I met you. Now, I've been in psychodrama. I've been in therapy. I've been medicated to the gills. I've been in treatment. I've been in jail. They all missed it. They tried, but they missed it. You can't treat a spiritual malady with a pill, powder, potion, or lotion. And although they meant well and they tried, they were throwing everything they had at my head. My head wasn't the problem, it was a symptom. I had to get the book Alcoholics Anonymous to find out that my head is not my problem. They kept trying to treat my head. They wanted to believe my thinking is my problem, and they even backed that up by saying it's in the big book. And that's not in the big book. There's a lot of misquoters running around AA. It says the problem centers in the mind. And Bill Wilson, when he wrote that, was referring to the mind's eye. I have a soul sickness. And because I have a sickness in here, it affects how I hear, how I think, how I feel, and how I see. Therefore, how I feel is a symptom. Anybody else got any feeling problems too? We got any feelers in here? Some of you feel like leaving yet? I mean, feelers. I think with my feelings. Isn't that something? And I was pouring Budweiser on it, and it made everything inside me A-OK without the message to me. There's no way I'm not going to drink. And I didn't know that that's what compelled me. And then the allergy, of course, once I started, the allergy kicked in and I was defenseless. And if I hadn't come to AA and found out factually that alcoholism is a spiritual malady, I would still be out there drinking, taking pills, powders, potions, and lotions to alleviate what I think is a thinking problem. Now, to be fair to them, it does look like I have a thinking problem. It does. But that's because they can't examine this. You and I can't examine this except through the four-step process. The four-step process says don't think about it. Do it. Everything in AA says do it. Then you'll know and you won't have to think about it. Isn't that something? It's such a powerful dynamic, this thing called AA. I remember when my sponsor, I got sober on November 8th, 1977, after being in AA for 5 years and not being able to stop drinking. I remember this one time, I'm going to mention it, I couldn't stop. But I couldn't imagine life without it. I couldn't. Could you? I could not imagine life. I mean, I got relief. Here's abnormal drinking. When you put the bottle in your hand and you get relief without drinking it. Now, that's bizarre. Have you ever been feeling bad and somebody gives you a drink and it starts to go away already? That's not normal. My thirst has never been quenched by holding a bottle of water. I have a different kind of thirst. I have a thirst that I didn't understand or comprehend till I got to you guys in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you helped me to understand that my thirst goes beyond here. My thirst goes where no expert can go. They go in here where Budweiser has a way of reaching. I mean, Budweiser can get down here and alter my perception of reality. And when I tell an expert that, they say, no, it doesn't. Doesn't do that. Doesn't do that. Alcohol is a depressant. How many of you heard that? Come on. Alcohol is a depressant. Well, to them, it is. Biochemically, it is. Ethyl hydroxyl, the active ingredient in alcohol, is supposed to sedate the normal drinker, and it does. My sister's one of them. You know who they are. They're easy to spot. They talk stupid. For example, my sister, she drinks mixed drinks. She likes slow gin and orange. They call it a slow screw because it sneaks up on you. So I'm out with my sister. I'm sober. I'm having a Coke. My sister's ordered a slow gin and orange and ice. But why ice? I don't understand. And she'll sit there and we'll chat. And she'll order the drink and she won't even take her first drink for a half hour because she's got things to talk about. I'm preoccupied with her drink. I'm watching, I'm wondering, take a drink! That was a sip. Sharon, look at the ice. It's melting. Look, you see that clear liquid that's above the booze? That's melted ice. Drink it. It's drowning the booze. She'll say, well, if it's bothering you that much, why don't you drink it? And on another time, we'll go out, and she'll have one. She'll drink the whole thing, hour and a half, but she'll drink it. We'll be playing pool. And then I'll say, Sharon, you want another one? She'll say, nah, I better not. I'm starting to feel it. Okay. And she says, as a matter of fact, you better drive. I lose my mind. That's a normal drinker. You see, booze is doing to her what it's biologically indicated to do. It is sedating her. 9 out of 10 drinkers, it does just that. But Dr. Silkworth says that an abnormal drinker like me drinks because I like the effect produced by alcohol, and that it performs an unusual action on me. Even though it is in the process of sedating my central nervous system, it is enveloping my soul. And I get this burning sensation in my soul. And what happens to me is I begin to get so good looking I can't stand it. I make stupid decisions and quite proud of them, I might add. Alcohol does something it's not supposed to do. It allows me to dance on death tabletops naked. Now, ordinarily, I can't even look at myself naked. But when I'm drinking, I want everybody to. Come on. Where's that come from? My sponsor, when I was new, I'm going to describe myself new. I got about 6 minutes. Right? Oh, I do? Oh, cool. When I was new, I want to describe myself for you because this could be an illusion to you. When I came to you guys, my psych report, my last one, I weighed 146 pounds. I was skin and bones, no teeth. Funny thing, ignore your teeth. They will go away. Floss, that's all I got to tell you. I'm like a man who's lost his teeth. I can't grow new ones. And usually right about there, I can't get a date neither. I weighed 146 pounds, no teeth, smelled from the street. And I came into AA that way, and you sat with me. You know, we don't get too many people like that anymore in many meetings. And a lot of groups don't know what to do with people like that. They just don't know. My group did. I was lucky. I had a bunch of old-timers. My sponsor was a guy by the name of William Barney Barnett. His sponsor was a guy by the name of Clarence Snyder. And his sponsor was Dr. Bob. So my lineage was only two stops, Barney, Clarence Snyder, and Dr. Bob. And when Barney died, it was a devastating thing because Barney was my sponsor for 29 years, 5 months, and 14 days. And when he passed away, I cried. And by the way, I don't want to get into that thing, are you a man that can't, all that stuff, you know, blah, blah, blah. When Barney died, I cried. And why? Because he done for me. God used him. Because nobody else could touch me. Barney had this way about him. He scared me. And I'm not too scared of people. I'm scared of imaginations. Anybody else scared of the dark in a lit room? I got paranoia that's interesting. Now, tell me, how many speed freaks we got in here? I'm not going to go outside the AA, but a lot of you are speed freaks, and you have paranoia from speed, right? That's a different kind of paranoia than alcoholic paranoia. Here's my alcoholic paranoia. I think the car in front of me is following me. Have you ever looked in their rearview mirror and thought, he's looking at me? He's following me. And then I turn off to see if he's following me. And I can't find him, so I catch up to see if he's still following me. I mean, I'm out of my flipping mind. And I also want to share my treatment plan with you before I tell you that story. Here's why. I have a sponsor today. Barney died. My sponsor today is Tom Ivester from Southern Pines, North Carolina. Tom is sober over 50 years. Good man in AA, well-respected. I have a home group, Seminole Beginners Group, on Tuesday night, St. Matthew's Church, Seminole, 7 o'clock. If you're in the neighborhood, stop by. And I also am a member of the Monday night speakers group in St. Pete. Come by and we'll treat you right. So I have a home group. I have my sobriety date. I have a sponsor, and I sponsor others. I'm connected. And that's not a bragging point. It's survival. I would have never believed that. And it's critically important that I do it for fun and for free, that I give of myself, just like being asked to come over here. By the way, I love doing this. Don't get me wrong. I enjoy doing this. I have all your attention. Well, most of you. Have your attention. How perfect is that? I'm sober. No pills, powders, potions, or lotions. And I'm not afraid to leave this room. And the doctor was wrong. The judge who told me that I have to be medicated or I can't leave. And if he finds out I'm not medicated, I have to go back. I haven't had to see that judge for 32 years and 9 months. Isn't that something? See, that's the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. I became a cop sober. Did I tell you that? Did I mention that? I usually save that for last, so any of you who resent cops won't take it out on me by ignoring me. I became a cop sober. I did. It's hard to become a cop. I just want you to know that. It's hard to become a cop when you've been arrested 9 times and you've been psychiatrically institutionalized 17 times. Hard to become a cop. Unless you live in Iowa. There they consider it a good experience. When I was new, now I want to tell you why I love doing this. I really have never been trained, taught, never had speaking. I mean, I understand your terror. The first time they asked me to come do this, I was horrified, and then something began to take over. You know the effect produced by alcohol is spiritual-like? This is not spiritual-like. It's spiritual. When I walk into a room of Alcoholics Anonymous, something begins to envelop my spirit, and I almost always leave better than I felt coming in because something in these rooms, it doesn't happen anywhere else, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, I get along out in the earth world pretty well, but what happens here doesn't happen in church. I became an ordained minister after I was a cop. I was trying to hit for the home run, you know what I mean? I have had the privilege of preaching in front of many, many people. It usually only takes about 20 minutes to loosen up their wallets. I was proud of that. And the feeling was grand, but there was no recovery in it. There's no recovery in it because church is not a treatment for alcoholism. I wish it was. It's just like love. Love is nice. Love is what we wrap the bitter, painful pill of recovery in so it's tenable. If love was the solution for alcoholism, we wouldn't need AA because lots of people love me. The problem is graver than that. The problem is what Chuck C. said, a conscious and unconscious separation. Is a conscious and unconscious separation from God. Chuck C. said it. I believe it. Conscious and unconscious separation, in his words, from a loving God. I'm here to report to you tonight that I believe that my only problem in life is my conscious and unconscious separation from my loving Father God. And my distance from God, and by the way, I also want to tell you that God and AA are synonymous to me. I believe God and AA are the same thing. I quit looking for God a long time ago. That doesn't mean I don't seek for higher ground. But I quit looking because I know I found it. Remember those, well, some of you young people know it's like on the level of 8 tracks, if you know what I mean. Back in the day, they had these little red buttons called I found it. Some of you 40-year-olds know. And you know, I started hearing people in AA talk about it, I found God. And I always wondered what they meant by that because my daughter was pronounced dead and put in a body bag, and she came back to life. And she told me the story about the light. But all she saw was a bright light. She didn't see a figure. So I don't know about this God thing. Many of us are vexed by this God thing. And then one day it occurred to me. I started talking to people. I asked them to describe for me, what do you mean when you say, I found God? What do you mean when you say that? Do you mean he gave you a parking meter? What's it mean? And I came away with one word. After interviewing hundreds of people in AA, what did you mean when you said I found God? And here's what I came away with. They found hope. And is there not hope in this room? I've never felt hope. I've felt hopeless as far back as I can remember. And I came here to AA having failed every attempt at institutionalizations to recover. And I had to come into a room full of people that were failures like me. I'm so glad, by the way, you shared your failure before you shared your...